Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barbara and Jenna Bush aren't your average twins. The only children whose father and grandfather were U.S. presidents. The only first twins. Now they are grown, career women, one a mother, and they're out with a new book about the privileges and the challenges that came with having your family in the public eye. This hour On Point, Twin Tales from the Bush Daughters. You can join us on air or online. How do you remember the Bush twins during their family's White House years? What's your question for Jenna and Barbara Bush? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Jenna Bush Hager, co-author with her sister of the new book, Sisters First, Stories from Our Wild and Wonderful Life. Daughter of former President George W. Bush, granddaughter of President George H.W. Bush. Today, she's a contributing correspondent for NBC's Today Show and editor-at-large for Southern Living magazine. Jenna, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having us, Jane.
And with her twin sister in the Washington studio, Barbara Bush joins us, co-author with Jenna of the new book. Today, Barbara is co-founder and CEO of Global Health Corps, a nonprofit that works to improve healthcare around the planet. Barbara, great to have you as well.
Hi, thanks, Jane. Thanks for having us.
And listeners, you'll find an excerpt of my guest book, Sisters First, at our website, onpointradio.org. So congratulations to you both on the book.
Thank you.
What's your message in the book? What did you want to convey, Barbara?
Well, we, Jenna and I, have been so lucky to have each other our whole life. We're obviously twins and had a best friend and a partner and everything born in with us. And as we've gotten older, and especially as Jenna had one daughter and was about to have another, we had the luxury to reflect on our own sisterhood and how powerful our sisterhood has been in both providing the support for us to be more brave than we maybe ever thought that we could be, and also the support in navigating life and the complexities that life presents to us and to everyone. Mm. And so largely, I think our book really is a love story to each other, with the broader message of how powerful sisterhood can be, whether it is your blood sister like us or a best friend or a colleague or the support system that many women have or should have, so that we can all know that we're enough and see ourselves as enough in the world that we live in and fully live out what we want to be.
Hmm. Love to talk more about that as we go through the hour. Jenna, you write that you hope to dispel some of the stereotypes maybe that are out there about you and your family. Was that a goal for you as well?
It was. My sister has always talked when she started Global Health Corps about the single story. And I think in this world that we live in, more maybe now than ever, with the rise of social media and headlines, constant headlines, it's so easy to stereotype people, to put them into some sort of box. And for twins, who Barbara and I in particular look so different, it was really easy for people who didn't know us to say, oh, and I hear it even now as a 35-year-old mother, oh, you're the troublemaker, which is hilarious because I go to bed at 8:43 p.m. But she's the quiet one, or you're the one, that the extrovert, she's the introvert. And I think for twins in particular, it's easier for people to create these comparisons that we had to be one or the other, that we couldn't be a complexity of different things. Mm. And so we realized that. I mean, people will say that to us all the time. And so it was really fun to explore who we are and to take back our own story. we actually use the subtitle Stories from Our Wild and Wonderful Life, and particularly the play on wild. It's from a Mary Oliver poem. But the word wild is fun to take back because I think we've heard before, oh, those wild Bush twins.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the headlines, right, from your young adult years, Jenna and Tonic, right? People Magazine, yes. Double Trouble.
Right.
I think Newsweek had it busted again in Margaritaville. I mean, it yeah. goes on and on. Were those hard to hear? Was that hard to read? You know, what's it like to see yourself in the headlines as you're growing up and so young?
I think it was. I mean, I think it was hard for us to read, for sure. I mean, that period was difficult in some ways. In other ways, we were raised to be sort of ourselves, to make mistakes. And so in retrospect, you know, people are like, do you regret anything? You know, of course, if it could have not happened, that would have been great. But at the same time, we don't regret not living up to other people's expectations of us. You know, it was good that we could be 19 and make mistakes because, frankly, as a mom now, had our parents wanted us to be perfect, which I think is impossible, I don't know if I could be the type of mom that I want to be. So, yes, seeing those things didn't feel good. It's hard to remember how bad it felt, but I definitely think it caused anxiousness and we felt bad for our parents, even though we write in Sisters First that after we called our dad, he apologized to us because he didn't want to see us splashed over the headlines either. We were 19. The pictures were horrible because we were freshmen in college and had probably stayed up late studying and eating one too many Oreos. But other than that, you know, we look back on those memories with, you know, I think anxious for those girls, reaching out to those girls in ourselves, but also okay with the fact that we made mistakes, and I think we're tougher for it.
I remember in the book, your father, George W. Bush, when some of these things were happening, said, you know, he's pretty tough. You know, we gave you, what was the word? We gave you freedom. We gave you space. This isn't it. You know, mm-hmm. stop, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely. I mean, I think they were disappointed, but at the same time, there was a lot of talk when he became elected of, you can be normal. Don't worry, you can be normal. I think that's because it's what we wanted to hear. We really were desperate to be normal college freshmen. And so I think we were all a little naive in what normal means and what that meant for us.
So, Barbara, it's such a rare perch being a first child, being first children. How did it change you, and do you miss it?
Good question. Well, I think it changed our lives in so many ways, in ways that I probably haven't even fully absorbed. We were so the age that we were when our dad became president was pretty perfect in many ways. It was certainly awkward in that I was going away to school, as was Jenna, but I chose to go to a school where I didn't know anyone. I made the decision to go to Yale because I love the challenge of creating a life and being outside of my comfort zone and making friends and knowing that I can, you know, build a life wherever I am. And that's something that I get a lot of joy and satisfaction out of. But of course, that was sort of an uncomfortable time to try to do so when our dad was running for president and Yale was certainly a political campus. Alongside that, though, I think, as Jenna said, it made us both much tougher and I think also more empathetic in that we completely understand how people can be reduced to headlines and yet the magic of people and how complex they are. And I think that that's a lesson that we learned. And then more broadly, our lives were opened enormously because of the position that my parents were in that when we were in college and right after college, we were really, like most people, trying to figure out how we wanted to be in the world and how we wanted to sit in the world and what we wanted to do. And we were given the incredible opportunity to travel with our parents around the world. I went to 5 continents with them and meet incredible people ranging from Wendy Kopp, who started Teach for America, to Vaclav Havel and unbelievable other people. I talk about meeting the U.S. men's basketball team in Beijing. And I think largely by meeting these incredibly inspiring people who were all really following what the right path was for them, showed us how to do that and also opened up opportunities for us to figure out the work that we could do. And I work in global health now, and I can pretty much say that's completely because of the exposure that I got from traveling with my parents to other countries and across our own country. It really showed me issues that I wanted to affect change on, and also showed me inspiring people that were working every day to do so.
Jenna, last January, as Malia and Sasha Obama were getting ready to move out of the White House, you both wrote them a letter, and in it, you said that they would continue to confront, quote, the harsh criticism of your parents by people who've never met them. What did you want them to know about your experience, about what their experience might be post-White House? I get the sense that you really see yourselves in them in many ways.
Mm-hmm, definitely. I mean, I think, and the reason why in particular is they have each other. There's two of them, just like there's two of us. I also, because of interviewing their parents and witnessing as we showed them around the White House, their mother's love for them, know that they have as tight of a family, or believe they have as tight of a family that we do. So in so many ways, we saw ourselves in them. Plus, when they entered the White House, they were the same ages that we were when our grandfather became president. And then again, when they left, they were the same age as we were when our dad became president. So we understood a little bit about what the childhood felt like, the magic and the wonder of seeing the White House as a 8-year-old girl. And then also the challenges of coming to age, of being a teenager, of being a college student, where you're wanting to explore and understand yourselves and frankly, make mistakes. And so we wrote those letters. The first one, as a welcoming in some ways, and because we saw ourselves in them. And the second, really to thank them, because it's, you know, I think people forget, it's not like there's no guidebook for first children. It's not like first children sit their parents down and say, you know what, I have a great idea. You run for president and I will be the first kid. You know, it's not like there was any really choices for us or for them. That said, it was also a battle cry for others. I'm not sure if people took it that way, but just to let them grow, let them be, to leave them alone. And it seems like that has happened, which makes us really happy. And also, you know, that we know by watching everything they did, which we write a little bit about, the fact that they traveled the way that we did, that they will be very, very great contributors to our world.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with sisters Jenna Bush Hager and Barbara Bush about their new book, Sisters First, Stories from Our Wild and Wonderful Life. Here's Jenna as a contributing correspondent on the Today Show, interviewed her grandfather, George Herbert Walker Bush, to mark his 88th birthday. Here they are sitting by the ocean in Kennebunkport, Maine, talking about his 1992 loss to Bill Clinton.
20 years ago, when you lost, was it a hard feeling?
Terrible feeling. Awful feeling. And I really wanted to win and worked hard. And later on, people said, well, he didn't really care. It's just crazy.
I believe in
free, I worked my heart
fair
out.
Trade.
And it was terrible to adjust. But then you figure, well, life goes on. Just do what the next challenge is.
And here was my guest grandmother, Barbara Bush, in 1994, as former First Lady, speaking to Barbara Walters. She did not mince words.
You said in yourself in the book when somebody said, why are you so popular?
Rice and Gorbachev asked me that.
And you said?
I said, because I'm fat and old and nobody feels threatened by me. I think that's true. I mean, I think you can sort of relax.
Listeners, you can join the conversation. What do you think when the tabloids covered our Bush, Jenna and Barbara Bush's youthful adventures? What'd you think? Did you judge? Let the girls be girls. Leave them alone. Jenna and Barbara, your father, former President George W. Bush, delivered a speech last week. Got him a lot of attention. It was titled The Spirit of Liberty at the George W. Bush Institute in New York. These are his comments, some of them, on the political discourse today.
We've seen our discourse degraded by casual cruelty. At times, it can seem like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than the forces binding us together. Argument turns too easily into animosity. Disagreement escalates into dehumanization. Too often, we judge other groups by their worst examples, while judging ourselves by our best intentions. Forgetting the image of God we should see in each other. We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America.
Barbara Bush, what did you make of your father's speech, and what do you make of the divisiveness that he talks of there?
Good question. Well, I loved his speech. I'm not at all surprised by his remarks, because they're very much in line with what he believed when he was president. It's just interesting how with time they seem different in a new context. But I was really proud that he made it. And his desire not to be an isolationist is so similar to kind of my own work. I work in global health. I work across five countries right now. And again, I figured out how I fit in global health because of his work with PEPFAR, which is the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which opened my eyes to affecting change in global health, which we talk about, or I talk about in Sisters First. But in terms of the divisiveness, that is definitely something that is worrisome to me and to my sister as well. And I think part of why when we decided to write Sisters First, it felt like the right time in many ways, because again, Jenna mentioned before, I love the concept of not single storing people, and I fully adopted that from Chimamanda Adichie. That is not my own concept, but it seems really easy right now with the way that we communicate, whether it's Twitter or online, to one, be able to say things without ever having to look someone in the face and have a conversation about them, and two, to reduce people to an adjective of what they might be, rather than the fact that it's so magical to be hundreds of things as people. We're so multifaceted. And that's why it's so much fun to meet others and interact with them. And I think that that's sort of the beauty of being alive. And yet right now, the discourse is so different than that. And so that's worrisome to me. And also something that I think part of why we wanted to share various stories of ours, both around forming our own opinions and living very different lives than other people may have assumed, is to sort of build out our own narratives.
And so, Jenna, to that point, what would you say about our political climate today, and to the many conservative and liberal listeners right now, about how to better debate our politics, our values, our ideas, just based on what you've been through?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And frankly, I've realized as a mom, I didn't have children when I voted in any other elections. This is the first time in our political history that I have two little humans that I'm raising. So I would say on a human level, the discourse isn't something I'm happy with. The way that people talk to each other, the empathy and compassion seems to be missing from a country that I know it exists in. I mean, I've seen it. Barbara and I write about traveling around the country and meeting people who are doing such good. I see that every day in my sister, who works every single day tirelessly to make sure that people around the world have access to health. I see that in my colleagues at work. And so as far as the way that people are talking to each other, you know, it bothers me, because if my daughter, who is 4, spoke to a preschool friend the way that others are speaking to each other, I would be sad. I would feel disheartened. And so I think it let's try to be kind to each other. I mean, it seems simple, but I wish we would go back to some of those basics. Barbara writes a really great chapter about conversations, having conversations with my parents about different political views. And for some reason, it surprises people. I think we're in this type of world where nobody's hearing each other out. We come from a political family where even among politicians, we could sit down and have a gentle, kind conversation. If anything, it was us as teenagers that got heated, not our parents.
And so that's interesting, Barbara, because you're, well, both your political views, you're not rubber stamps of your family or your parents even. I mean, Barbara, you said you voted for Hillary Clinton for president. You've endorsed same-sex marriage back in 2011. How do you talk about divergent political views around the Bush family table? I mean, give us a sense of how you debate hot political topics in your own family.
Absolutely. We do. We definitely do talk about political views. And I do say this in the book. I think people assume that when we sit down at dinner, it's sort of like a Model UN debate, which is often not the case. But we talk about our lives, but we definitely talk about political views. And I share an anecdote about, as you mentioned, I came out for gay marriage in 2011, and I made a video in New York City. And then was thrilled that gay marriage did pass and was happy that I was able to be one small part of lending my voice to that. But prior to that, I had, as I write, I had had a number of conversations with my parents about my views around that. And it started really when I was in high school, and gay marriage wasn't even on the table in the United States. But I write about just gay rights and being, you know, having the kind of sass that a high schooler would have, and assuming that sitting down talking to my dad about my stance on gay rights and his, you know, coming in heated and coming in hot. And he sat there and listened to me. And in many ways, he didn't get defensive. He listened to me and he allowed me to continue talking and shape my own opinion, which, of course, your opinion gets more refined and more refined as you listen to other people and have discussion. And so flash forward, when I was asked to make the video, I felt strong in my own beliefs because I had wrestled with them with others, particularly in my family. And after making the video, I was really surprised because a number of people would come up to me on the street and still do and say things along the line of, wow, that's so brave that you betrayed your family. Mm-hmm. And I was so taken aback by that comment because in no way was it a betrayal to my family that I shared my voice. Mm-hmm. I had talked to my dad a number of times before making the video about whether or not I should do it. And it was much more around my own comfort putting myself out there. I've intentionally chosen to be private, but was also raised by both my mother and my father to use my voice if I could be effective in doing so.
Let me play that that ad that you did in 2011 for LGBT advocacy group Human Rights Campaign.
I'm Barbara Bush, and I'm a New Yorker for marriage equality. New York is about fairness and equality, and everyone should have the right to marry the person that they love. Join us.
So it's interesting, Barbara, you were talking about different ideas and wrestling with these and, you know, divergent opinions and how we debate better in this country. I want to listen to this latest NRA ad. It's not about the right to bear arms, but seems like a call to arms in some sort of civil war. This is talk show host Dana Loesch describing universities, top government officials, the media and billionaires. They're calling them saboteurs who are attacking the sitting president, his supporters, even our system of government.
But the ultimate insult is that they think we're so stupid that we'll let them get away with it. These saboteurs slashing away with their leaks and sneers, their phony accusations and gagging sanctimony, drive their daggers through the heart of our future. Their fate will be failure, and they will perish in the political flames of their own fires. We are the National Rifle Association of America, and we are freedom's safest place.
So it's really the tone that I want to get to by hearing that, Barbara and Jenna. You know, what do you make of that today? What do you make of that, not just the position, but the tone of the position?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that tone is probably extremely effective because it's definitely fear-inducing. I think largely, and it's sort of, I like that you played the two ads next to each other because there's such a juxtaposition. But to me, the kind of idea of us versus them is not one that that resonates with me. And I can say that it for many reasons. And one, of course, is that I do work in the field of global health, where people often think global health issues are another people's problems in another part of the world. And that's not true. And the only way that we'll solve them is if we sort of think, you know, we're all part of the globe and it's all of our responsibility. And so I think about that every day when I go to work, which is, you know, a different context than what you just played. But I think broadly, Jenna and I, and part of many of the stories that we share, is that there is such a common link to humanity. And the broader, one of the broader themes of our book is around sisterhood, which is not just about us two as sisters, but broadly the idea of sisterhood, which is a we mentality rather than an us versus them mentality.
I wanted to ask you both, you're both so articulate and thoughtful in your answers, and I'm just curious how you have dealt with people who disagree, sometimes vehemently, about your father's policies, even about his presidency. We found this sound of Matt Damon in 2006 on MSNBC talking about your father, President Bush, the Iraq War, and sharing the burden of fighting.
If you're going to send people to war, if we all get together and decide we need to go to war, then that needs to be shared by everybody, you know? And if the president has daughters who are of age, then maybe they should go too.
And here's your father, President George W. Bush, visiting Brazil in March of 2007, where he met with the president of Brazil, Da Silva, but also by protests against the Iraq War. And here's some sound from the streets of São Paulo. So what is it like when people disagree with you pretty vehemently? I mean, a lot of listeners here have some tough questions about your father, about his policies. What do you say to them?
So I wrote about that exact quote that Matt Damon said in Sisters First.
In the book, Jenna, yeah.
Yeah, I did. And the reason why is that, well, one, I am a fan of his acting, and it hurt when I, as a teenager, to hear that. You know, of course it hurt. And one of the reasons why it hurt is I understood why he would say something like that. That said, our job as his daughters isn't to judge his political decisions. We just can't, you know, and we wrote about this to Malia and Sasha. We see our dad as our dad, and people should understand that. I mean, if they love their family, we love him. We see him as so much more than just political decisions, although, of course, that's part of who he is and how other people see him. But we have a fabric of memories that have been woven together from the moment we were born of our father. We see him as the man that was home at 5 p.m. so he could run with us. I see him as sitting at our kitchen table helping me with my math homework patiently, even though I was a horrible math student. we see him as texting Barbara every single morning to make sure she's okay, to Barbara reaching out when she had a heartbreak. That's how we see him. And I think, again, if we're talking about humanity, which is what you've brought up several times now, and the discourse around kindness, people should allow people to see their parents the way they want to see them. And also maybe not judge. We weren't political. We were college students. I was a teacher. Barbara worked in Africa. We weren't part of his administration. So it's hard to – I know that people don't always agree with him, and that's okay. That's why we live in this country. But I think most people have been kind and haven't come up to his daughters, who they know, of course, love him, with anger or with comments that know that they would hurt us, because they understand that, of course, we see him differently.
And so, Barbara, what was it like for you during that time after 9/11, during the Iraq war? I think it was you, Barbara, who talked about, you know, signs in your college dorm opposing your father, and that was hard.
Yeah, of course. Yes, I did write about that in Sisters First, and that was hard. That being, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But one thing is, of course, we knew that this was part of it, and I think, my parents 100% knew going into being running and then being elected, of course, that this comes with it, that everyone will have opinions because everyone is American and feels ownership. You know, not everyone. Everyone in our country is American and feels ownership over their country. And that comes with the territory, of course. I think for me, as Jenna kind of mentioned, it was more difficult when I was younger to separate the political from the personal. That was something that I struggled with at the beginning. And when I chose to go to Yale, it was during the election, and Yale was an extremely political campus and a very liberal campus, of course. And so I don't know that anyone voted for my dad. I'm not sure. I did. And so I just, you know, got used to the discourse and could see people for who they were and also make room for their political opinions. But they were often respectful to me in knowing that I, of course, was my dad's daughter.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Sisters Jenna Bush Hager and Barbara Bush join me today to talk about their new book, Sisters First, Stories from Our Wild and Wonderful Life. And a reminder, you can find an excerpt of my guest book, Sisters First, at our website, onpointradio.org. President George Bush provided comics with a lot of material with his style of speech and occasional malaprops. Here was comedian Robin Williams in London, England in 2008 at a royal comedy special in the waning days of the George W. Bush presidency.
He is a gift to comedy, though. He is a comedy pinata. I'm going to miss him. A man who said, I'm the decider. No, sir, you're the president. You make decisions. Deciders, what they sell in the little jugs. A lot of people. He also said, I am misunderstimated. And went, no, not really. And you think, what is he? Well, I have to think, what is he going to do after he leaves office? No, he cannot go on a speaking tour. That's a given.
And during their father's presidency, the Bush daughters made headlines, as we discussed, and they were fodder for late-night comedy on their own. Here's a 2005 Saturday Night Live sketch where Jenna, played by Amy Poehler, and Barbara, played by Tina Fey, are in their bedroom in the White House. Jenna wonders if Dad could tell if she'd had a little bit too much to drink.
Oh, my God, Barbara, I'm so wasted. Do you think he could tell?
Probably. You were line dancing and your shoe totally flew off.
Oh, God, Barbara, I got the spins.
Jenna, I told you not to drink straight tequila.
I didn't. I mixed it with Captain Morgan.
Listeners, you can join the conversation. What do you want to ask the Bush sisters? Let's get some callers in here. I've made you wait. Kate, sorry about that. You're calling from Springfield, Ohio. Welcome to On Point with Jenna and Barbara Bush.
Hello, Jane. I wanted to, first of all, address something, Jane, you had said. You had asked the question, how do we encourage debate? And I just want to give kudos to this show because I do think it makes us think, and it is a nice, calming way that we can discuss different views.
Good.
But
thank you.
To Jenna and Barbara, I'm part of the club. I'm not a first child, but my grandfather and father actually served with your grandfather. And so I, too, am a child of politics on the national scene. And I'm curious, I've often been approached to run for an office. And what I'm hearing you say is, the public office, while growing up in it, developed us into maybe some thick-skinned and very appreciative and open-minded and perhaps even articulate people, it also made us push away from the idea that I will not allow my family to be open to that kind of ridicule or that kind of attack because, again, as a child, I was 6 months old when my father ran for Congress, all I see is daddy. You know, all I see is mom and dad. And so I have a very apolitical stance. I love our system.
Yeah.
I've seen it from the inside out.
But sometimes it chases away good people. Kate, I hear you. Jenna, Barbara, do you have any thoughts about that?
I totally understand that, and I think you should run. That said, if you're interested in it. And it's funny, people used to ask us, I don't think we're apolitical, Barbara and me. I think we're actually both pretty interested in policy, which then, you know, makes you political by nature. That said, there are sensitivities around it, which is what you're talking about. It's hard to – it's a little bit trickier. But people used to ask Barbara and me all the time because obviously we come from a political family, like, are you – will you run? And it, when they used to ask, we would sometimes answer in unison, slightly defiantly, no. And I'm not sure if that's because we wanted to separate ourselves from our family. We wanted to create our own names, which is should be our right as humans. But now we have a little bit of a softer no. I think we still think we won't. But the reason why is that we do want good people to run, just like you said, Jane. We're desperate for smart, capable people, and particularly women. I was riding in the car with my daughters the other day, and Mila said, my four-year-old said, Mommy, Poppy rules the world, about her baby sister who's two, which, of course, if you've read our book or want to read Sisters First, part of the theme is women lifting women up. And I loved that. I loved that at four she was all, not comparing herself to her baby sissy or how much attention they got. And I said, well, maybe, Mila, one day she could. Maybe one day she could be president. And Mila said, but, Mommy, presidents are men. And it's true. There's nothing I can say to refute that. Although I guess I could point out to other countries that have elected women as presidents. And I said, well, we can maybe change that. So I think part of why we wrote Sisters First is to talk about conversations around women and electing women into higher office, but also getting them into the boardroom, having an aunt who started a global health nonprofit, having more women like you, Jane, in the media. So I think you should run if you're interested. And I don't know if that answered the question.
All right, Kate, but you've heard it here. Thank you very much. Thanks for
no
the
pressure.
Call. Right. So, Barbara, tell us about Global Health, this nonprofit that Jenna just mentioned. You're so involved in health issues, and I'm specifically curious what the role of government should be in, for example, the opioid epidemic. Today, President Trump said he would declare the opioid crisis a public health emergency. What would you tell him about that issue based on your experience and what you do now full time?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it is an epidemic in our country, and it needs to be addressed critically. And I see that with our work in the United States. Global Health Corps is a nonprofit that's focused on developing young leaders who serve in the field of global health now and go through our program, which shapes them to have the frameworks and skill sets to change policy and advocate in entrepreneurship so that throughout their lives they can affect change in global health. And we're really taking advantage of the fact that there are so many young people interested in social change, which is a huge positive and makes me extremely hopeful, regardless of how divisive our country may be. And so when we work in the United States, we work in Newark, New York, Boston, and D.C. on whatever the most pressing healthcare issues here are. And they're broad, and they actually don't look that different than many other countries. For instance, in D.C., around 1 in 20 people is HIV positive, which is a similar rate to the work that we're addressing in Uganda or Rwanda or Malawi.
Wow.
And that's something we don't talk about in the United States very much. But what to me is quite hopeful is our Global Health Corps fellows, they're all 30 and under, are from around the world. And it's a global community of young leaders who are solving global health issues. And so they can share, you know, best practices from what might be working in Uganda to think about how to better serve people in D.C. or vice versa, and really creating a global movement of young leaders to affect change is a hopeful way to look at it. And I think one big piece of that is I alluded to this earlier. When I tell people I work on global health issues, they usually are shocked when I mention that we work in the United States. And again, we're part of the globe, and we have equally as pressing healthcare issues here, and we do need to see ourselves as a we to address these issues.
So, Barbara, you're at Global Health. Jenna, you're at NBC, and I wanted to ask you about the media today. You know, of course, we cherish free media in this country. It's not perfect, but it's part of the very essence of democracy. And so I'm curious, now that you're part of it, what do you think of this moniker, fake news?
You know, it's complicated. I am happy with the job that I do because I get to tell the stories of incredible people that are making change. It's not something I saw myself going into. I've been there for 8 years now, which is hard to believe. But if you had told me 10 years ago I was going to do it, I would say absolutely not. I was teaching in inner city D.C. and West Baltimore and really happy with my work. That said, I think now more than ever, and I'm sure you feel this way, or I assume you feel this way, journalists are really important. I do more human interest stories, but it's important that real news is getting out there, obviously, and that we are holding people accountable. I think fake news is hard, and I don't know I don't know enough about it. But the fact that you know, there's, for example,
I guess the question is the president's use of the moniker fake news.
You know, you mean saying that, real news is fake news?
Yep.
Is that what you're trying to say?
Yep.
Yeah. I think people need to be smart, and they need to read the news for what it is and get a couple different sources and understand that what one person says may not always be the truth. I think most people, I mean, I don't know, but I hope most people are willing to see different sides of things and not just read one hashtag and think that that one hashtag equals truth. I think it's important for all parties to hold each other accountable, and I hope that people are doing that. I hope people are really investigating, reading newspapers, listening to a couple different sources, because it's important that we hold everybody accountable.
Let's get Patrick in here from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Patrick. Glad you waited, and welcome to the program with Jenna and Barbara Bush.
Yes, thank you for having me on, and thank you for the public services that Jenna and Barbara provide to our country. This is really wonderful to have them on the show. I have a question for them.
Oh, dear. Patrick, please try back. I think his question was about the future of the Republican Party. And as I'm reading here the notes from our producer, if the Republican Party has changed since your father, President George W. Bush, left the presidency, do you see a shift? Do you see a move toward harder right sort of policies? How do you see the party changing, if at all? Jenna, Barbara.
Good question. And thanks, Patrick. Can allude back to a question that you spoke about earlier when you played our dad's speech, the speech that he gave in New York City, about a week and a half ago. And the reason that I allude to that is what he spoke about in terms of immigration and not being an isolationist is the same rhetoric that he used when he was president, and it are the same values that he held when he was president as a Republican. And at the time, I don't know that it would have garnered much attention. Obviously, he was written about plenty and covered in the newspaper, as were his policies. But they were written about more recently as a different voice, as values that didn't seem to be the same as representing the Republican Party. And so because of – I think that's an example of a juxtaposition that does seem values or beliefs have changed. And of course, that's normal with time and context. But I think I can say that we don't necessarily, and we write quite about this in the book Sisters First, by sort of have hard party lines. We really believe in being critical and open-minded to issues and values that are being presented. So I think it's likely changed, but I can't fully speak because we're not necessarily wedded to the idea of one party.
And I think I'll just jump in quickly. I think it depends on which Republican. I mean, I think that that's part of, and we're not experts, so I don't know. But I'm just saying it's good maybe when you talk about discourse to look at person by person instead of larger groups of people. I think then maybe we can get into really understanding some of the complexities.
Ray, thanks so much for the call.
just have a couple of minutes left here. You had some funny anecdotes in the book, some sort of insider stories, if you will. One about your grandmother, Barbara Bush. You tell the story when you were about 7 in the White House. You were visiting just after your grandfather was elected. You discovered the bowling alley in the basement for the first time. You tell the story of how you called down to the kitchen, right, to get some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches delivered to the bowling alley. Is that true? And tell what your grandmother did.
That's true. I don't even know why or how we decided to pick up in the phone and order, but I think it just seemed like, you know what? We can do whatever we want. So we ordered the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and we were waiting for them to come. And then instead of somebody delivering the sandwiches, it was our grandmother who had caught wind of our order and came down and really reprimanded us. She said, "This is not a hotel. You may not order food. And, you know,
and don't ever do that again.
Don't ever do it again. Right. Go to your room." Something like
and we
that.
Definitely never did it again.
We were able to eat sandwiches again, but only when it was time to eat lunch and upon our grandmother's offering.
Yes. And what about your father's late blooming obsession with painting? Did you see that one coming?
We did not see that one coming. I don't think our dad saw that coming, which is quite fun and what makes life so interesting. But when he left the presidency, he, of course, had more time on his hands. And his obsession with painting actually started with just sending little drawings to Jenna and me. We write about this when he left the presidency, he was able to get a smartphone because during his presidency, he didn't have one. And he would send us little updates of what he was doing every day. That was a little sketch that he did on an app. And if he was flying somewhere, it would be a little picture of him waving out of a plane. And quickly thereafter, he started loving those little drawings. And my mom saw them and commented on a line that he used, I think, and sort of gave him praise around that. And quickly thereafter, he was taking painting lessons, and he was studying classes online at the MoMA and getting spruced up. And now he spends every single day, hours every day, painting. And his most recent muses are wounded warriors, and they're men and women that he has gotten to know both personally in his work with veterans. And now he also paints portraits of them as an homage to them and their service. And they're really beautiful and really complex, and he's an artist.
Who knew?
Last 20 seconds. Jenna, how did the White House transform your father, would you say?
I mean, I think it transformed him in so many ways that it's even hard to know. I don't think that's an answer I can answer in 20 seconds.
All right, we'll have to have you back.
Okay, we would love to, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jenna Bush Hager, co-author with her sister, Barbara Bush, of the new book, Sisters First, Stories from Our Wild and Wonderful Life. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. Listeners, thanks to you as well. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.